Good morning, everybody. My name is John. And I'm a real alcoholic. This has been a long weekend. I want to start off by thanking the committee for giving me the opportunity to come and carry the message in Alcoholics Anonymous. And let's give the committee another hand. They've done a fine job, didn't they? Both Lorna and Joe, they did a really good job. Let's give the speakers that was before me a hand. You know, I want to start my talk off this morning by saying that since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's God has been real good to me. I didn't even realize what was going to take place when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And God has given me the very best that I could have gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sponsored by some of the finest men that one could wish to meet in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first man that was ever placed in my life, I was on my way out the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in Daytona Beach, Florida. And I came to a conference, and I say, man, I don't fit in with these people. I was just getting out of prison. I didn't have very much, and I looked around, and all you guys looked real good, and you had your suits on, and the ladies had on pretty dresses. And I said, man, this ain't for me. And that Saturday night, Keith Lewis was the speaker. And I was in the back of the room, and I noticed Keith kept watching me. And I'm saying, why is this guy watching me? And then I said, well, this room is full of people. He can be looking at anybody. But shortly after Keith got through speaking, Keith came down. He greeted a few people, and then he beelined straight for me. And when Keith got to me, he took me by my hand, and he told me he was glad that I was there. And he was honored to have met me that weekend. And he welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, man, I'm important. The speaker was glad to meet me. I'm going to keep coming back. And if there are any newcomers here this morning, I want to say to you that you got a home here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had some of the best sponsorship that a man could have in his life. For the first 9 years of my my recovery, Lee White was my sponsor. And Lee did everything for me that a good sponsor would do for a sponsee. But Lee and I grew close. And we began to be like brothers instead of sponsoring sponsee. And Lee started loving me too much to tell me the truth about me. See, I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. If you don't tell me the truth about me, I'll just stray off somewhere. And so Lee said, John, I think you ought to get another sponsor. And he pointed me to Ed M. And for the last 3 months of Ed Mutum's life, he was my sponsor. And it was as though he was trying to pour a part of him into me. You know, Ed put something in me that'll last me a lifetime. And then Ed passed away. And Dick was, and Ed were good friends, and Dick began to sponsor me. And Dick has made a big difference in my life. See, Dick helped me understand that God didn't get me sober just to be sober and just for AA. God got me sober so that I can live. That I had a job in life. And one of my jobs were, how do I spend my time as a husband? How much time of my life do I spend as a father? How much time of my life do I spend as a good AA member? How am I as a good employee? See, I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous got us sober so that we can do the things we should have been doing anyway in life. And I'm so honored to be here this morning. Ever since I've been here, I've been happy, and there was just a great spirit that's been flowing over this conference this weekend. My sobriety date is April the 18th of 1998. I'm a member of the Central Group of Orlando. And if you're ever in Orlando and you want to have a meeting with some real alcoholics, we sit right off of I-4 on Colonial at the corner of Broadway and Colonial. And we'll be more than glad to have you there. And you have a good time. My home group is full of real alcoholics. I love my home group. When I first got out of prison, I hadn't connected back with my family. And I told Lee was my sponsor during that time, and I said to him, I said, man, I don't know what to do. I haven't connected back with my family. It's Christmas time, and I don't have anywhere to go. He said, John, you got plenty of family down at Central. I'll pick you up in the morning, and you'll spend Christmas at Central. So sure enough, Lee picked me up Christmas morning, and he took me to a meeting down at Central. And the meeting started about 10 o'clock. About 11 o'clock, I can smell aroma from that food. And I'm saying, man, is they going to ever end this meeting? You know, the food began to smell really good to me. And so finally, they came to an end about 12 o'clock. And we all went back there. We began to fix plates. And I fixed me a nice plate of greens and cornbread and turkey and dressing, you know, all that good stuff. See, that was an upgrade in my eating. They don't feed you like that in DOC. But I turned to Lee and I asked Lee, I said, well, Lee, who do I pay for this? He said, John, you don't pay for this. This is for free. See, that was different for me. Everything, where I had come from, everything had a price tag on it. Nothing was free. And I used to go to a lot of meetings with my sponsor when I first got out of prison. This is the way he would introduce me to people. He would say, meet John. He one of them bad kind of alcoholics. And I said, man, this guy gonna have everybody thinking I'm the worst guy in the world. And I stuck around the room and I watched you all and I said, now these some bad alcoholics. See, I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. The reason why I say I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, my family told me so. My friends told me so. Brevard County Sheriff Department told me so. The Department of Corrections told me so. Even the statistics was against me. The statistics say that 90% of the men get out of prison return within the first year. But since I've been in the program of Alcoholic Anonymous, I hadn't had the obsession to commit the type of crimes that land me in prison. It's been 11 years since I had to jump a fence. Now when I see a police officer, I don't see him as my enemy. I see a police officer as an outstanding citizen doing a good job in society to keep us safe. And another reason why, you have to be an alcoholic of a hopeless variety for these type of events to take place in your life. I remember I was riding a bike. My license was suspended. And one night, a police officer pulled up on side of me and he said, stop. And I was trying to stop, but I was riding that bike pretty fast and it didn't have no brakes on it. So when I finally got the bike stopped, he jumped out and put handcuffs on me and put me in his car and took me to jail. The next morning we went in front of the judge. The judge said, read off that gentleman's charges. And they charged me with fleeing and eluding a police officer on a bicycle. And the judge kind of laughed about it too and gave me time served and kicked it out. There was another incident I had when my license had got suspended. I used to have an automobile, but I didn't have license, and I stayed about 4 or 5 blocks from the store. And I said, man, there's no way the police gonna get me between here and the store. I'm gonna take a chance. I'm going to get what I need, and I'm gonna come straight back home. So I got in the car, and I got about a block and a half, and the blue lights came on. And I knew my brother's date of birth and social security number. So he came up and he knocked on the window and he asked me for my ID. And I said, I don't have it. And I don't have ID. And he said, give me your date of birth and social security number. And I gave him my brother's date of birth and social security number. Instantly, I became Larce Ohana. And so he took my brother's name, date of birth, and social security number, and he went back and he run it on the computer. And he came back and tapped on the window. And I said, yes, sir. He said, Mr. Hunter, would you step up? And when I stepped out, he began to put handcuffs on me. And I turned to the officer and I said, what are you doing? He said, you're $18,000 behind in child support. Another reason why I say I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, I can remember getting out from work with my friends. I used to do construction work. And we'll stop by a bar. And we'd have a few drinks. And they get that little woozy out of control feeling. They say, wait a minute, man, I had enough of this. I got to go home. I got some chores I need to do around the house. Man, I need to spend some time with my wife and children. I've been neglecting them enough. I'm going home, John. And you see, that was different for me. When I started drinking, I forgot about wife, chores, children. I forgot about everything. And that little woozy, out-of-control feeling they get, that's an in-control feeling for me. That's the feeling I drink for. And there would be times people would come up to me and say, John, don't you think you're drinking too much? I tell them, get back. I can handle mine. If you see me in a barrel fight, help the barrel. Don't help me. And there were times I would drink until I would have to vomit. And I was going back to the bar and I was vomiting. At times I would vomit blood. And I would come back and ask the bartender for a cup of ice. And I would eat that cup of ice and cool my stomach off, and I would continue to drink. In 2005, I got a letter from GSO. And they invited me to Toronto to speak on a topic called Do You Think You're Different? Man, I went over, I got in my car, and I tore out over to Lee House. I said, Lee, look what I just got. And Lee showed me his letter. I got one too, John, and so But he took my letter and he read my letter. And he said, John, you know you can't leave the country without reporting this to your parole officer. So I got in my car and beeline for the parole office. I got down there and I said, Mr. Kimmel, I got something I want you to read. And I gave it to Mr. Kimmel, and Mr. Kimmel read, and he looked up at me. He said, you got to be out of your mind if you think I'm letting you leave the country. Oh, man, that was heartbreaking. I got in my car. I made it back to Lee House. I said, Lee, Mr. Kimmel said I got to be out of my mind if I think I'm going to leave the country. He said, John, write this, sit down. I sat at Lee's table. He said, write the judge a letter. I wrote the judge a letter and told him about going to Canada and all, but I thought I also should tell the judge what a fine citizen I had became in society, that I was now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't belong on parole anymore. And I mailed that letter. So when I got to court, he went to court with me, and I was sitting there, and they called me up, and the judge said, Mr. Hunter, do you want to say anything on your own behalf? And I said, yes, sir. And I began to tell him why I shouldn't be on parole. And he said, I don't want to hear it. And me being the fine alcoholic that I am, I'm not going to stop at that. So I continued to try to tell him. He said, didn't I tell you I don't want to hear it, but you can go to that AA thing. And so, me and some friends, we got a flight into Buffalo, and we rented a car in Buffalo, and we drove over into Canada, and I had a real good time. I can remember being on the 22nd floor of the Intercontinental Hotel, and I was looking out the window, and as far as I could see, all I seen was name badges that said, I am responsible. And I began to tear up, because I knew that that was the handwriting of God. There was a lot of alcoholics there. You know, if for that many alcoholics to be together and there ain't a fight in the crowd, you know, God got to be in the midst. You know what I'm saying? Look what God can do. That's what I was thinking. I want to talk to y'all a little bit this morning about my childhood and my past. I'm not going to tell you from this podium that my childhood and my past made me an alcoholic. Usually you have to drink some whiskey to become an alcoholic. But when I got the alcohol, it sure did help me with my childhood and my past. I was born in a little town called Statesboro, Georgia. My father was a sharecropper. My mother was a Southern Baptist. My mother taught me everything any good mother would teach her child. My mom made me go to Sunday school on Sunday mornings. She made me go to church on Sunday afternoons. My mom made me go to Bible study during the week. My mom even sat me down and taught me the golden rules. She told me, she said, baby, if you're going to make it in this world, you're going to have to learn to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But about the age of 9, something happened. My mom passed away. And when my mom passed away, all that passed away. My father was a chronic alcoholic. There was times I went to school on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of my shoes. There were times I went to bed hungry at night. There was times I went to school and my clothes wasn't too good, and kids would make fun of me, and low self-esteem set in instantly. There was times I would do stuff to try to get the teacher's approval, and that didn't even work. I had older sisters and brothers, and I knew if I could just make it to their homes that everything was going to be all right. And I would get there, and they would put me down. So I felt inferior to less than everything and everybody at a real young age. I can remember my father coming up in the driveway, and I could hear his horn outside blowing. And I always had to make this decision. Was I going to help my father and be embarrassed in front of my friends, or was I just going to leave him out there? And my decision was always this, that I was going to help my father no matter what. And I would go out and I would get my father, and I would begin to bring my father in the house. And I would hear my friends say, look at John. He got to drag his drunk dad in the house again. See, I felt that those kids were better than me because I never seen them drag their father in the house. I can remember standing to my bedroom window and looking out, and kids would be playing catch football with their fathers or wrestling around in the yard, just having a good time, just them and their dad. And I would be looking out that window, and with that little mind I had, I would instantly blame God. I would say, what kind of God would take a 9-year-old boy's mother? But standing to this podium this morning, I know that I have to let God off the hook. Because God left me with a father who wasn't willing to step up to the plate. About the age of 14, I got interested in girls. What do you do when you get interested in girls? You go to the teen center. And man, I would get there and I could smell that perfume on them girls. And I said, man, these girls sure smelling good. And they're looking good too. And you know what? I'm going to dance with me one of these girls tonight. And that song would go off, and then another song would go off, and I'd look over there and I'd see some guy with some Chuck Taylors and Levi's on the floor, and the girls would have a circle around that guy. And man, they would just be dancing with that guy and having a good time. And I said, that's what it is. It's the Chuck Taylors and the Levi's. How many of y'all know about Chuck Taylors and Levi's? That's old school. And I would go and I would save my money and I'd buy me some Chuck Taylors and Levi's. How many of y'all know I was a guy standing up against the wall with a pair of Chuck Taylors and Levi's on? See, there was something on the inside of me that would not let me respond to things on the outside of me. But my father came up with this idea. He said, John, I think you ought to go stay with your aunt and uncle in Statesboro this summer. And we was living in Vero Beach during that time. And I said, okay. And I got to Statesboro. And I had two cousins a little older than me. And one Saturday night, they asked me, did I want to go to the dance? And I told them, I'd love to go to the dance. And we got in this little farm model truck. And off to the dance we went. We was on a dirt road. And there was a little house sitting there. And we stopped, pulled up in the guy's yard, stopped and knocked on the door. And an elderly white man came to the door. And they asked him, would he sell us a pint of moonshine? He closed the door, he came back out with a pint of moonshine in an MD 2020 bottle. If any of y'all know about bootlegging, you know that combination. We got a pint of moonshine and got in the car and heading off to the dance. One of the brothers took a swallow and gave it to me. I said, I don't want that. He gave it to the other brother. We got to the dance. The other brother took a big swallow and passed it to me. I said, I don't want that. He said, man, take a drink of this. It'll make you feel good. And I took a big old swallow, and I can remember that just like it was yesterday. You know, Dr. Sitworth said, you shall remember. I love carrot cake, but I don't remember my first slice. I can remember my first drink. There was a warm, burning feeling went out on the inside of me. And when it hit the pits of my stomach, felt like my stomach expanded. Felt like my head exploded. Felt like I was 10 feet tall, bulletproof, and instantly good looking. Remember I said I was shy about dancing with girls? I wasn't shy that night. I had it going on. I danced with all those girls. Guess what? That night, there wasn't no low self-esteem. See, alcohol did something for me nothing else had ever done. Alcohol brought me out of a bad place. For many years, alcohol wasn't my problem. Alcohol was my answer. Alcohol didn't become my problem until I was put in prison for a long period of time, and I needed an answer, and I needed an answer quick. And by the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was presented to me, because that was the only answer I ever found for my life other than alcohol. And I would go home, when I got back home that summer, I began to hang out with some of my friends. And they had a little experiment, been doing a little experiment in drinking. We would get together, we would pool our money together. And we would buy alcohol and other substances in the morning. Now I may say something one or two times in my talk about drugs, and it's not because I belong in Narcotics Anonymous, I'm an alcoholic and I'm at home. Right now, if you put a pile of crack up here in front of me, I'd call the police on you. You give me a drink of whiskey, I'd kill you about that pile of crack. When I drink alcohol, I become open to everything. And we would buy little things together, and there would be times we didn't have money. And I used to wear a leather jacket, and I could put 3 fibs of MD-2020 in the back of that jacket, and you'd never know it. There were times we would be riding at night, and they'd say, man, we fixing to go home. And I say, drop me off. And I would continue to drink. How many of y'all know you can't stay in school long drinking MD 2020? So I was kicked out of school, and my father and sister said, you need to go to Job Corps. And I agreed. They said, you need some type of education. So off to Job Corps. I got the Job Corps. I'd done good for about 2 weeks. After I started drinking, I only done good with anything no more than 2 weeks. And there was a guy that was from Kentucky that went on a Liberty trip with me. And he said, John, this bus will ride a half a gallon of liquor. I said, man, stop playing. He said, John, I ain't playing. So we went and got a half a gallon of Bacardi rum, and the tire was turned kind of like upside down in the bus. And he got up on the bus and put a half a gallon of Bacardi there. And when we got back to the Job Corps Center, the Bacardi rum was there. We did that a couple of times. How many of y'all know you can't stay in Job Corps long drinking Bacardi rum? It wasn't long before I was expelled from Job Corps. On the way home, I made my mind up that I was going to live the way I wanted to live. See, I wasn't afraid of my father anymore. I wasn't afraid of my sisters and brothers anymore. Alcohol had gave me all the courage I needed. And I was going to live my life the way I wanted to live. I felt that I was ready for the world. I got home, I began to hang with the drug dealers. I began to sell drugs. I was able to buy a few toys. I was able to dress the way I wanted to dress. Most of all, I was able to drink the way I wanted to drink. Tom Collie, Scotch Collie, Hennessy, Ballantine. I had a lot of fun drinking for a long time. My story is different than some people's story. Some people say that alcohol quit working. Alcohol never quit working for me. My last drink was just like my first one. Alcohol did what it was supposed to do. I just got tired of the consequences. Somewhere in life, I crossed an invisible line, a place of no return. My drinking wasn't fun anymore. The police began to get mad with me. They began to put me in jail. And I would be in jail for a period of time. And my head would clear up. And I said, man, when I get out of this jail this time, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to get me a job. I'm going to go back to school and get me some type of education. I'm going to do right by my family. I got my mind made up. This time, I'm going to do the right thing when I get out of jail. And the day would come, they would let me out of jail. And I get just about a mile from that bus stop. And the disease of alcoholism would begin to speak to me. And this is the way it presented itself. John, you know, it's been a long time since you had a beer. One won't hurt. And I'd get off that bus with the mindset of having one beer. And it would hurt, and I'd be off and running until the next time. There were times they would put me in prison for periods of time. And while I would be in prison, I'd write my family and tell them, I found religion. I'm a saved man. I walk after the things of Christ now. My life isn't going to be that way anymore. It's going to be different when I get out. I'm going to continue to walk after the things of God. And my family would believe me, man, and they would send me commissary money. You know what? I believed me. And if they had gave me a lie detector test, guess what? They would have believed me. See, I was always making a resolution, but never a decision. At that time, I didn't know that a decision had to be followed up by an action. And I would get out of jail. I would get out of prison. And it would be 2 weeks before my family would see me. And when my family would see me, they say, you're the biggest liar we know. But what my family didn't understand, I was doing the best that alcoholism would allow me to do. I was living in Melbourne, and I met a young lady, and believe it or not, there's women looking for guys like me. So I met this young lady, and she really was good to me. And she said, John, you know what? It's Melbourne that got you drinking and drugging the way you're doing. My mom lives in Atlanta. Why don't we get my mom to get us an apartment and her husband get you a job? And we move to Atlanta, and we can start all over again. You know that what? That was the best idea anybody had presented to me in a long time. A change. Geographic cure. I came to Atlanta, and those people really tried to help me. Guess what? I crushed their hearts. You know why? They sell whiskey here in Atlanta, too. You can't outrun this thing. You take it everywhere you go. I was working at the Video Ingram down in Norcross. And I met a guy there, and he had a toy poodle. And he said, John, my dog is bad about chewing on electrical cords. I have to keep everything in the house unplugged. One night, he failed to unplug a lamp. And that little toy poodle got a hold of that lamp, and he said, you can hear that dog holler all over the house. I said, yeah. He said, not John. When I go home, I waved that card at him. I said, what'd he do? He said, that dog holler all over again. That dog had more sense than me. That dog didn't want no more. The thing was hurting him. Guess what? He never had the obsession to chew another electrical cord. But you take me. Alcohol can beat me up one side, tear me down the other side, cause me to lose the best relationship I ever had, put more space between me and my family than there ever been, take my daughter out of my life, and put me deep in prison than I had ever been. And the day they let me out, you wave a ball at me, I'll do it again. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that our dilemma is a lack of power. I have no defense against the first drink. You know, I can remember the time that I would be on, standing on the street corner, and my family would come by, and they would say, just come go home with us. My appearance had begun to fail. They said, come go home with us. If it ain't but for one day, please come go home with us. And I would look in that car and I would see all that shame and pain on their faces. And I said, man, I'm not going to hurt them like this anymore. I'm going to go home with them. And I get in the car and they stop to a department store and they buy me clothes, take me into their home and give me a nice warm meal to eat, allow me to have a warm shower, give me a clean bed to sleep in. And I look by and I see that pain and I said, man, I can't keep hurting them like this. I'm not going to hurt them like this anymore. And about 2 or 3 days go by and I begin to get irritable and discontent. And my mind would go to screaming. And I needed a drink. Somebody know what I'm talking about when I say I didn't say I wanted a drink. I needed a drink. My mind would go to screaming. And I know if I got to a drink of alcohol, I could quiet my mind down. And I would go leave the home with the mindset, I'm going to this corner store, I'm going to get me one of these tall boys, and I'm going to quiet my mind down, and I'm going back because I'm not going to hurt them anymore. And I would go up and I would drink that beer. And I forget about that family I said I wasn't going to hurt anymore. Remember, that's the family I said I love. That's the family I said I wasn't going to hurt anymore. But I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't stop drinking. You know, getting toward the end, it had got really bad. My sister came on the street corners with an insurance policy, and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, please sign this insurance policy. I need something to bury you with. Because the way you're living, you can't live long like this. And I got to see that shame and pain in her face. And I signed that policy. My sister had, what she had done, she had heard about what I was doing on the streets. The drug dealers would be making a sale, and I'd run up and snatch their customer's jewelry and run with it. And at times, the drug dealers would say, man, give him something to get him off the corner. He bad for business. You know, you're in a world of trouble when drug dealers don't want you around. You know what I mean? How bad can you get? I can remember walking late at night, feeling all the guilt, the shame, and the pain. And I began to pray. And I would say to God, God, if I'm going to ever change, you're going to have to help me change. I can't do this by myself. I would have a pocket full of money, sometime a big bottle of booze, and sometime drugs to go along with it. And I would pray that prayer. And in about 3 weeks, my family house was surrounded by Brevard County Sheriff's Department. So this morning I want to tell you, be careful what you pray for. Because that morning I met a power greater than myself. I can remember them dragging me out of the house, not even letting me put a shirt on. And my family neighbors were standing in the yard. There's about 20 carloads of police there. And their neighbors got to see all this. And when I looked back at my family out the back of that police car window, I could see all that shame and pain again. And what I was trying to do was tell my family that I love them because I thought that was the end for me. I thought that April the 18th of 1998 was the end for me. I did not know that it was the beginning of a brand new life. They took me to jail, and I sat in jail for about 30 days, and a public defender came to see me. And he said, Mr. Hunter, they got you to the right this time. And the state attorney want to ask for 30 years on each charge. And he don't want to run them concurrent. He want to run them consecutive. What they want from you, Mr. Hunter, is a total of 60 years in the Department of Correction. And he got up and he began to walk away, and I called the public defender, and he turned and looked at me as though, there's nothing I can do to help you. And he continued on. About 2 weeks later, About 2 months later, they came and got me and they took me in front of the judge. And I was in the holding cell and I seen the public defender and the state attorney come out the courtroom though. And I'm thinking, what my public defender done? He done butted up with the state attorney on me. And the state attorney came and he bent over to the chute and he said, Mr. Hunter, I got you to the right this time. If you plea out to 30 years, I run the other 30 concurrent and you only have 30 years. And the state attorney got up and walked off. And the public defender bent over to the chute and say, I think it's a good idea. You ought to take it. And I bent over to the chute and told him, you take it. That didn't, 30 years didn't sound like a good idea. And then they took me in front of the judge and the judge said, Mr. Hunter, how do you plead? And I told him that I plead to the mercy of the court. And the state attorney said, Your Honor, before you go on any further, let me show you this. And he pulled a television set up and he stuck a videotape in it. And it was me as plain as day, just like you're looking at me. And the judge said, Mr. Hunter, with your prior record and this videotape, I'll probably go along with the state. And I said, Your Honor, if I get that type of time today, you're going to have to give it to me. I will not accept it from the state. He hit the table. Bam, get him out of here. Recess. And so I went in the holding cell and it was about an hour gap in between things. And I got on my knees while I was in that holding cell. And I asked God, I said, God, if I get 30 to 60 years today, let it be your will and not theirs. An hour went by, they took me back in the courtroom. The judge told my public defender to approach the bench with the high obituary papers. He told the state attorney, approach the bench with the high obituary papers. And then he had to present the high obituary papers. And the judge began to flip through his folder. He said, I can't find them. And my attorney said, Your Honor, would you state that a little clearer for the record? He said, I can't find them. But I'm going to give him every day I could give him by law. And by law, he couldn't give me but 5 years in the Department of Correction, followed by 4 years probation. If the high obituary papers is not in the judge's folder 30 days prior to sentencing, he can't sentence a man as a high obituary criminal. See, there's not a second guess in my head why I'm here this morning. I'm here this morning because a loving God looked upon me and showed grace and mercy. I told you that the video was clear as day. If I got what I deserved, you'd have a different speaker this morning. I went back and I stayed in jail another 2 weeks before they sent me to the Department of Corrections. I stayed in the Department of Corrections for 4 years and 3 months. I said the same prayer for 4 years and 3 months. Every time they let me out on the recreational yard, I would walk around that recreational yard and look up at that razor wire. And I would say, God, you didn't make me to be caged up like a wild animal. I'm not asking you to get me out of here. What I'm asking you is when I get out of here, you help me be a better man. Help me be a blessing to my family and not a hindrance. I was forced into a TIA program. When I was forced into the TIA program, that's where the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was presented to me. I had a counselor by the name of Mr. Elkins, and me and Mr. Elkins clashed a lot. One morning we were sitting in group, and Mr. Elkins called me out. He said, Hunter, do you think you're powerless over alcohol and your life were unmanageable? I said, Mr. Elkins, why are you calling me out in front of this group of men? Me and you had plenty of one-on-ones. He said, I didn't call you out, convict. I asked you a question. He said, approach my desk. And when I approached Mr. Elkins' desk, he shoved the book in my hand. And he said, I challenge you to read this book. And I took the book and just mad all out of my head. And I went and sat down. That night, around count time lasts about an hour. During count time, I began to read that book. And I read anywhere from 3 to 4 pages. And then the book asked me a question. It asked me, had I ever been defeated by alcohol? And then God gave me a moment of clarity. I can remember the times I promised my daughter I was going to take her to Disney. But due to drugs and alcohol, I spent all my money the night before. I can remember the times when I had an eviction notice for my place. And I had the money to pay my rent with. But due to drugs and alcohol, I got evicted. I can remember the times that I used to like to fish. But because of drugs and alcohol, I didn't own a reeling rod or any tackle anymore. I can remember the time when a woman and 2 little kids was living in an apartment with me. And we had the final notice on the light bill. And I had the money to pay that light bill the next morning. And with everything in me, I'm going to pay this light bill in the morning so that this woman and kids don't have to be in the dark. And that drink thing hit me in the midst of the night. And I just wanted a bill to take the edges off. Y'all know the rest of the story. The woman and the little kids had to live with me on the candlelight. The next morning when I went back to group, Mr. Elkins could see that I was torn up, that I was broken. And Mr. Elkins called me from the rest of the group and he took me into his office. And when Mr. Elkins closed the door, he said, "Hama, what's wrong this morning?" And I just burst in tears. And I told Mr. Elkins that alcohol had became my master and I was its slave. And Mr. Elkins put his arms around me. And he said, "I've been hearing it out your mouth. I've been hearing it come from your mouth, John. But this morning I hear it coming from your heart." He said, "John, now you got a place to start." Mr. Elkins began to work the steps with me in a short form. Shortly after that, I was transferred to Tomoka Correctional Institution. And while I was in Tomoka Correctional Institution, there was two guys from the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous by the name of Elmer and Andy that used to bring me an AA meeting. And Elmer liked me, and Elmer talked to me a lot. And Elmer said, "John, if you ever argue with yourself whether you can or can't drink, you probably will." And he said, "John, an alcoholic of your nature, if you don't put your feet in the room of Alcoholic Anonymous as soon as you get out of prison, you will drink again." And I had about 2 weeks left in prison, and they had started putting me on side the road picking up paper. One morning I was picking up papers, and I met paper, and I seen a truck coming, so I looked up at the truck and I had contact with a guy from my past. And I seen the brake lights coming on the truck. And I'm telling this guy, "Man, go ahead, you gonna jam my date, I only got 2 weeks left." But he stopped anyway. And he began to walk toward me and I'm saying, "Man, go ahead, you gonna jam my date." And the officer was standing there and he wouldn't say a word. And he allowed this guy to probably walk as close to me as from here to Dick. And he told him to stop. And he stopped and he said, "Hunter, talk to him." And I said, "Man, what's up?" And he said, "What's up with you? What you gonna do with your life when you get out of prison this time?" I said, "I wanna change, man." And he asked the officer, "Can I give him my number?" And the officer allowed him to give me his number. And when I got back to the compound that night, I called my sister and she did a three-way call. And the guy said, "Man, I know where a halfway house would be perfect for you when you get out of prison. Here's the address, write the people." I wrote the Recovery House of Central Florida. And they told me they would be glad to have me upon release from prison. So when I got out of prison, I went to the Recovery House and signed myself up in the Recovery House for another year. And so that night I called my family and they said, "Where are you? We thought you was getting out." And I told them, I said, "I'm out." And I say, "I'm at the Recovery House in Central Florida. I signed myself up for another year." They say, "You the biggest fool we know. You just did 4 years and 3 months in prison and now you're going to lock yourself away for another year?" See, my family couldn't see my fear. It had been the age of 14 since I had been sober in society and I wanted to win this time at all costs. See, there's a part of me that loved that madness out there. If I expose that part of me to that madness out there, I'll go out there and I'll stay. I won't make it back to the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous. I'm the type of guy that has to do what he needs to do in the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous in order to be sober. While I was at the Recovery House in Central Florida, there was a guy who used to bring a big book study every Thursday. Matter of fact, he passed that big book study on to me now. And he used to bring that big book study every Thursday. And on one Thursday, he didn't do the big book study. He told his story. And when he told his story, I heard my story. And I asked him, would he show me how to stay sober? He said, "No, I can't show you how to stay sober, but I'll show you what they showed me." And me and him sat down and we talked about steps 1, 2, and 3. And he took the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous and he flipped it over to page 98. And it said, "Burn this idea into the conscience of every man, that he could get sober in spite of anyone under these conditions, that he trusts God and clean house." He said, "John, I see that you trust God." He said, "Now it's time that you clean house." And he took me in his truck and he took me across the street and he bought me a notebook, tablet, and an ink pen. He came back and he drew 3 lines on that paper and he said, "I want you to tell me the name of all the people you hate, the resentment list." And don't you know I remember them all? Man, how can I forget that? That was it. You know what? That was easy. Then the next week he came back and he said, "Now I want to know why you hate them. Because, don't you know, I remember what they gone to John? I'm saying to myself, this is easy. But then the third week, he flipped the script on me. He said, now I want you to pray for him. I said, what? He said, yeah. And he looked at me and he said, John, you better mean what you pray for him. If you want to be sober, you got to mean business with this thing. And I said, okay, man, I'll mean it. And I prayed for him, and I asked God to let the kids be college graduates. He told me, and you ask God to give them what you would ask for yourself. And I told God to let the kids be college graduates. Give them the income they need to support their families. Let their marriages be happy. And some of them I couldn't pray for. And I told God, I said, God, if you want me to love this one, you got to love them through me so the love can be made perfect. Then a couple weeks later, he came back and he said, well, John, how is this praying business going? I said, it's going great, all but two people. And he said, John, who is the two people? I said, my father, who treated me so poorly as a child, and the girl who shot me in my back with a hunting rifle and caused me to lose my right lung, from which I swore I'd get even if I lived. And he told me, he said, John, have a seat. And I sat down. And he said, John, I want you to think of three of the worst things you ever did. And I thought of three of the worst things I ever did. And he said, John, do you think you should be forgiven? I said, yes, I think I should be forgiven. He said, John, I think you should be forgiven too. He said, John, the reason why you did what you did were because you were spiritually sick. He said, the reason why that girl and your father did what they did to you were because they were spiritually sick. That was good news to me that my father was spiritually sick. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man would send his 9-year-old boy out on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of his shoes. That meant to me that my father wasn't the type of man would send me to bed hungry at night. That meant to me that my father wasn't the type of man that would abandon me in the midst of a crisis. See, that my father, that what it meant to me was that my father was caught in the grip of alcoholism and no human power could restore him. My father didn't make it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I watched my father die of alcoholic death. And how could I hate a man like that when I had became that same man? See, here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't hate spiritually sick people. We pray for them. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous say that resentment is our number one offender. We must rid ourselves of resentment or it kills us. A resentment for me is like me taking this bottle right here, filling it up with poison and drinking it and waiting for you all to die. See, all those years I was dying on the inside and nobody knew it but me. I listen to a lot of gospel music. When I drive, I listen to music. I like gospel and I like some soft R&B. And I was listening to a R&B song a while back, and it was by an artist named Betty Wright. And she was singing a song called No Pain, No Gain. And somewhere in the midst of that song, she said, if you can receive the gift to forgive, a better and a longer life you will live. I said, what did she say? I rewind that. So that sound like AA talk. And she said it again. If you can receive the gift to forgive, a longer and a better life you will live. No pain, no gain. I'm thinking and I start to dissecting this thing. And I say, do she mean if I forgive somebody else that healing is going to take place for me? See, this is what I believe. When we hate a person, that's taking. When we pray for a person, that's giving. I never seen a person give spiritually and not receive. And I say, okay, by me forgiving somebody else, I can be healed. But the strongest part of that to me was she called forgiveness a gift. That means it don't come from me. That means that it comes from God through me. Ain't that something? And if I can, she said, I had to receive it. She didn't say it was already there. She said, if you can receive the gift to forgive. So I believe this is what happened for me. When I'm praying for you and asking God to give you everything I would ask for myself, that the gift take place. And I get set free and you get set free. Ain't that something? Isn't that something? Where else can we go and get this type of deal? I remember doing my fifth step, and I told my sponsor everything. I didn't know if he was going to call the police or not. But I knew that I didn't want to get drunk, so I told him everything. And I hear, you know, I'm standing to the podium, and this may not sound good, but I'm going to say it anyway. This is one of the biggest lies I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear people tell lies about things sometimes. I hear people get newcomers, and they tell newcomers, if you put half in, you're only going to get half out. Well, I got news for you tonight. If you put half in, you don't get nothing out. This is a nothing, all or nothing program. Half measures avail us nothing. This is an all or nothing program. We got to give it all. If you want what we got, then you got to be willing to do what we did. He asked me, he said, John, are you ready to have God remove your character defects? I say, what? He say, are you ready to have God remove your character defects? I told him, I said, yeah. He said, what are they? I said, I don't know. But he said, I know what they are. And I say, how you know? He said, while we was doing your fourth step and the fifth step, I was writing it down. He said, I wrote down here, you're a liar. You're a thief. You use women for your own selfish reason. You got a big ego. You're a deadbeat dad. And there were some other things he said. And he told me, he said, John, that isn't who you are. That's some dirty, rotten stuff you went through life and picked up. And if you give it to God, he'd move it. And then he pointed at me. And he said, John, I believe the dirtiest, rotten thing you ever did, you did it to survive. He set me free. Everybody else told me I ought to die for my actions and burn in hell. And some of them tried to send me. But he set me free. And remember when you first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, your character defects were your character. Right? And if you move it, what's left? A void place. And one of my mentors told me this. He said, write down what you would have God to be for you, your conception of God. I put down loving, kind, sharing, understanding, great sense of humor, forgiving. And when I'm practicing the characteristics of my higher power, it feels like I'm floating through the universe. And when it even get better. When I'm practicing the characteristics of my higher power with his kids, it feels like I'm just flying real fast around the universe. And that's what I replace my character defects with. And sometimes when they stick their ugly heads up and they do try that, I got enough tools to snip it right back off. Ain't that something? And he sent me back and he said, I want you to go back and do this. And he put me on the page for the seventh step. And I went back and I read the first five proposals. And then it asked me a question. Had I tried to mix mortar without sand? And I can honestly answer no, because I had been Thor from the very start. Then I began to write my eight step list. And he said, John, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my eight step list. He said, no, you're not. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you remember when in the fourth step I asked you, was you selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? I said, yeah. He said, that's your eight step list. I said, what? See, if I knew that he was going to use that to make me make amends for some of those people, I would not have been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate. See, it's easy to make an amend to who you want to make one to, but I didn't think I owed my daughter's mother anything. She took my parents to right for 9 years. But I wrote down that I had been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate toward her. And I said, and that was the first one he picked for me to make that right. And I said, man, you're going to open up a can of worms. These people don't want to hear anything from me. He said, John, just write the letter. I said, man, my daughter's never going to see this letter. He said, John, just write the letter. I went and wrote the letter, and I brought the letter back. And I say, please don't make me mail this letter. This letter is going to cause all kind of trouble. I don't want to mail this letter. He said, John, let's pray over the letter. We prayed over the letter, and we mailed it. A week later, I got a phone call. It was my daughter. She told me that she wanted to start and build a relationship with me and that she wanted me to be a part of her life. See, she's back. She's expensive, but she's back. My My daughter's a student in Tallahassee at Florida State University. I remember I went back to Melbourne and I was riding through Melbourne and I got up by this store and an Indian guy used to run this, Indian guy run the store still right now today. And it hit my mind that I need to make that guy an amend. And I remember he borrowed me off his property, so I kept going. What used to happen, I used to go in the guy's store and steal wine when I didn't have money. And he would try to come out and get the wine sometimes. And I would tell him, you don't want to go through this about this bottle of wine. And he'd go back. So finally he borrowed me off his premises. And I said, that's an amend I can't make. And I kept driving, and it became the strongest thing on my mind. Go back. Make that right. And I said, God speaking to my mind. I turned that car around and I pulled in front of that store and I didn't think about not doing it anymore. What happened was I thought about doing it. I'm going to do this no matter what the consequences is. And when I opened that store door, you know what that guy said to me? He said, you're a different man. And then he repeated himself. He said, you're a different man, with a smile on his face. And I walk up and I shook his hand and I say, I done you wrong and I'm here to make it right. He said, oh, forget about it. And I said, no, I belong to a fellowship. And one of the requirements is that I clean up the wreckage from my past. He said, if you made it right with God, you've already made it right with me. Ain't that something? Again, God doing for me what I could not have possibly done for myself. Step 10, I practice it every day. I sit down and take my inventory at night and look over it and see where I went wrong at. Step 11 and 12, I'm living in it all the time. Up on awakening every morning, I ask God to divorce me from self-pity, self-seeking, and dishonesty. To guide my thinking for the next 24 hours. And I pray for somebody else, not my own selfish ends. Step 12, guess what? I'm working that with that recovery house. I sponsor guys over there within their first year of sponsorship. A lot of them from far places. They leave and go back home, but I always go to the treatment center, and I keep me 4 or 5 sponsees. I got one that stayed, and he got almost 3 years now. You know, the 12 steps wasn't designed to take away who we are. The 12 steps were designed to take away who we're not. See, I always knew there was a spiritual solution. What I didn't know about was the program of action. My family used to get me and they get me cleaned up and they take me to church. And the preacher would do something called an altar call. And I would be sitting there and I'd be heard this message and I'd become broken. And I'd walk up to that altar and I'd raise my hand. And I knew that guy was offering some good stuff. And he'd ask me what was wrong and I'd tell him about my drug and alcohol problem. And he would anoint me with oil and pray over me. But there was one little slight problem. When I left that place, I always stopped at ABC. See, what I'm not saying that God couldn't meet me at that altar. What I'm saying is that my house wasn't in order to receive the things of God. The 12 steps that haven't had a spiritual awakening as what? The result of these steps. Guess what? After the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got ABC whooped. It don't even bother me. I can remember laying in the recovery house in Central Florida, laying flat on my back one morning, and all I could do was lay there and cry. Because I couldn't remember the last time I had possessed a drink of alcohol or drugs. Somewhere in the midst of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the obsession had been lifted. Ain't that something? Michelangelo was in front of a church and he was chiseling on this big ugly stone. And a little old lady came out of church and she said, son, why are you chiseling on that big ugly stone? He said, because on the inside of this big ugly stone, there stands a beautiful angel. That's the same way with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When they take away everything that's ugly, here's a room filled with beautiful angels. Ain't that something? Where else can we go and get that? But yet and still, there's a lie that sends the mind of every alcoholic that he can one day safely drink again. And if we get away from doing the things we need to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that lie comes alive. I got a bad bite. Some mornings I have to roll out of bed. And while I'm on my knees, I make use of it. I say, God, I offer myself to thee, to deal with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I may help. With thy power, thy love, and thy will of life, may I do thy will always. What I'm asking God to do is to move me out of the way so that I could be a maximum service to him and his kids. Isn't that something? You know, in order for me to get drunk today, I'd have to get drunk off a lie. I couldn't get drunk off the truth. Now, this is what I can tell myself and get good and drunk. You know, John, you're looking pretty good. You got you a gorgeous wife, your family back in your life, and you got you a nice automobile. And you work real hard. You deserve a beer. Now, I could drink, I'll bet. But if I say, John, this is the truth right here. If I say, John, when you open this beer, you're going to open the gates to the penitentiary. You're not going to have a wife because ain't no woman going to want you. You're not going to have an automobile because you're going to pawn it for drugs and alcohol. Your family ain't going to have nothing else to do with you. And they're going to put you deeper in prison than you ever been. See, that's what happened to a guy like me when you add alcohol to him. I've tried controlled drinking. It's that red liquor, I'll try a little white. It's that white, I'll try a little wine. It's that wine, I'm going to drink beer. The only way I can live a normal life, I have to abandon alcohol. The idea that I could safely drink has got to be smashed. I thought that I was weak until I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and got a hold to the big book. Bill said most of us was unwilling to admit we was real alcoholics. And then Bill told us how we had to get this thing. He said, we must conceive in our innermost self that we're alcoholics. And then Bill assured us that we can't drink again. He said that we're like men that have lost their legs. They don't grow new ones. Once losing the ability to control alcohol, we don't regain it. See, once I found out I had alcoholism, you all could help me. You told me that I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. You told me I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You told me I had to make a decision to turn my life over to the will of God as I understood him. You told me I had to get out of management because based upon my management skills, if I worked for a big corporation, I'd have been fired a long time ago. You told me I had to learn to live along spiritual lines. I was going to die alcoholic death. You told me that my troubles was of my own making and God was my new director. That he was the principal and we were the agents. He was the father and we are his children. And you told me that that concept was the keystone to the new and triumph arch from which I could pass through to freedom. And then you showed me a promise. You told me if I would stay close to God and perform his work well, that he would take care of me. See, I'm at a place in my recovery where either God is or he ain't. He's everything or he's nothing. And God is everything in my life. See, I walk by faith and not by sight. I'd rather walk alone with God in the dark than any man in the light. See, when I came into these rooms, I bought my worst and you gave me your best. And when I would make up, you told me to keep, when I would mess up, you told me to keep coming back. Everywhere else I went told me not to come back. And if I showed up to some type of function, they'll say, well, who told him? You know, some of y'all had pretty good lives. You graduated high school. You went through college. Some of you had your own businesses and stuff, and you was doing real good. And you ran into alcohol, and alcohol caused you some problems. And then you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and now you got it straightened back out, and you're able to move on with your life. But I got news for you. Alcohol didn't cause me anything. Because of alcohol, I never got anything. Alcohol got a hold of me about the age of 14, and it took off. But that today I own an automobile. I got driver's license, tag, and insurance. That may not be much to most people, but that's a big deal for a guy like me. You know, you gave me my family back. The family that said they was done with me and said they didn't want anything else to do with me, they argue about who house I'm going to come to for holidays. You gave me my daughter back, and we closer than ever. You helped me remember my mother in a special way. For what my mom was trying to do for me, you took the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you done that for me. And today I live by the golden rules. I do unto others as I would have them do unto me. I'm not selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate when it come down to my friends. Man, what a fellowship we got here. You know, I want to say this to the newcomers. You know, some of you been lied on, cheated, talked about, and mistreated. But if you allow the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to do what they're designed to do in your life, when they land you back safely in the Master's hands, he won't let you down. And I want to have a word with the old timers, with the ones that have been around for a while. I was reading this story and the old timers came to my mind. I was reading a story about the Good Samaritan. You know, there was a guy had been robbed on side of the road, and there were some religious people came by, and they were called Levites. And Levites couldn't touch of unclean things. And so what the Levites probably thought when they got up to the guy that had been robbed, well, we can't help this guy. What'll happen to us if we help this guy? And the Levites passed the guy by. And then some normal folks came by, and they didn't know where the robber may have been. And they said, well, what's going to happen to us if we try to help this guy? And then the Samaritan came by, and he flipped the script. He didn't think about what's going to happen to me if I help that guy. He thought about what's going to happen to this guy if I don't help him. What's going to happen to the newcomer that come through that door if we don't help him? Remember when we came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and they grabbed us and they loved us until we were able to love ourselves? Don't we owe Alcoholics Anonymous that much to give back to the newcomer? We got to be the Good Samaritans here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you guys have heard my story. And you probably say, you know, John had a heart, or John was bad and rotten or whatever. I don't know how you feel about me after hearing my story, but I know that my family was there and they seen it all. And sometime I'm at their houses and I'm having dinner and I catch them staring at me. And I say, what are you looking at? And they say, oh, nothing. I say, yeah, come on, tell me what you're looking at. And one day one of them told me, say, man, how did you do it? And I told him I was just like that old woodpecker. And he said, a woodpecker. I said, yeah, there was a woodpecker that got up every morning religiously and went and pecked on a hardwood tree to try to get the worms and mites out. And one morning that woodpecker went to peck on that tree, and a dark cloud formed over that tree, and a streak of lightning came out of that cloud and it split that tree. And the woodpecker began to eat the worms and mites. And then here come a whole flock of woodpeckers, and they joined him and they began to eat with him. And one of the woodpeckers looked up at him and said, how did you do it? And he replied, I showed up and did what I was supposed to do, and God did the rest. See, that's my deal here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I showed up and did what I was supposed to do, and God did the rest. I had a story about a little boy named Johnny. And I'm going to close with this. There was a little boy named Johnny. And Johnny was afraid of bad weather. And one night a storm blew in on Johnny, on the town where Johnny lived in. And the lightning began to flash, the rain began to flow, and the thunder began to roar. And Johnny got real scared and he hollered, mommy, mommy. And she run in there and she said, Johnny, what's wrong? He said, mommy, would you hold me until the storm pass over? See, Johnny didn't ask his mom, mom, could you make the storm stop? That ain't what he asked her. He said, will you hold me until the storm pass over? See, nobody promised us peaches and creams here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes we run until the storms of life. And it get rough sometimes. The lightning begin to flash, the thunder begin to roar, and the rain begin to pour in our life. But my friend, next time that happen, don't ask God to make it stop. Just ask him, say, will you hold me until the storm pass over? See, God has always held me. There's been deaths in my family. I hurt my back and couldn't work in 2 years. I've had a lot of things to happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, but neither one of those things have been bad enough for me to drink. You know why? Because I always ask God to hold me until the storm passed over. And I love y'all, and I'm glad y'all gave me the opportunity to carry the message.